our monthly night of worship and prayer happening at 6:45 to 8 p.m. I invite you to come and pray together as the church. Second thing I want to tell you about is Maundy Thursday. Now, I know some people would say, what's Maundy Thursday? I say this with a smile on my face. We've celebrated Maundy Thursday for 5 years now. So I need to tell you about it still, because it's one of those words, you go, Maundy, what's that all about? And Maundy Thursday is on the week of Easter. What Maundy Thursday recognizes is the night that Jesus had the Passover meal with his followers. And so one of the reasons why we meet on Thursday night, there's just something about a meal shared together as the family. And so that's really important, and it's a potluck supper. It starts at 6 o'clock. But then it's also the point in Holy Week where we remember the death and the suffering of Jesus. And if we go from Palm Sunday and arrive on Resurrection Sunday the next week without pausing at the cross, we've missed an important part of that week. For Palm Sunday led to the cross. And so on this particular year, it's called Journey to the Cross. And we're going to walk through 8 stations of the cross. Different churches will have 12, 13, 10. And we're going to do 8 stations of the cross that come out of the scriptures. And it's going to be interactive in that Maddie's asking kids to read scripture. Linda's talking to some people to read the prayers that go along. I am looking for 8 speakers. There's a short paragraph, a speaking part at each station of the cross. And so if you would like to share in that, it's super easy. But what happens is we will go through the cross, each station of the cross, and there will be 8 candles across the front. And as we go through each station, we extinguish a candle one by one. And the lights begin to go down until the last candle, when Jesus breathed his last. And what happens that night is we leave on that note. We're going to clean up after supper, and we're going to leave on that note. And it's difficult for us because we want to jump to the resurrection. But we need to leave on the note, Jesus breathed his last and he was buried. Sunday morning, what will happen is when you arrive here, you're going to find that the doors are closed. And the greeters are going to ask you as you come in to come in quietly and to remain seated quietly until we start. Because essentially what we want to do is we want to start on Sunday where we left off Thursday night. So the lights will be out, you will hear a sound, and then we will begin to celebrate that Jesus lives. So hopefully that helps to understand what that looks like. So supper's at 6 o'clock. The service starts at 6:50, and it's a 30 to 40-minute service. I don't know. It depends how fast everybody reads, right? Because there's parts that we move through, and there's also singing. Every station will have a song, part of a hymn, part of a song that picks up on the theme of that particular station. So if you would like to be a speaker, reading a short paragraph, I have 8 of these. Please speak to me. I'd love to give to you one of them. One more thing before I give you the coffee question. The African Children's Choir is coming, and we need 7 homes. So I'm going to pass these clipboards around. If you can take 2 or 3 children and a chaperone, if you put your name down. Now, you might say, well, I might get 10 names. Whatever you fall on the list, stuff happens, right? It might come to that weekend and one family, they get sick that weekend. They go, oh, we can't have the kids here. We don't want to get them sick. If I have alternates down, that would be a tremendous help. The kids like to share a bed. So if you have a double or a queen bed, they'll sleep in that. There's a chaperone that makes sure they shower, they brush their teeth. You don't have to do any of that. They're going to arrive in time for supper on the Saturday afternoon, so you'll be able to feed them, whatever else you do. But I remember when they came to Revelstoke, bedtime's around 7:30. These are the smaller kids. You give them breakfast in the morning, and they're going to come and they're going to do 45 minutes for us of music and dance. And then we're going to feed them some lunch and they're on the way to their next spot. So if you could help by taking 2 kids, and there's be a few that have 3, If there's three, they still sleep in the same double queen bed. They love to, they're not used to having a single bed all by themselves. So if you can do that, that would be a tremendous help. Thank you so very much. Now, we're studying Acts chapter 8. And I need to just do a little setup, and then I'm going to give you the question. But in Acts chapter 8, what we've done is we, in Acts 7, Stephen, who was one of the seven deacons of the church in Jerusalem, had been arrested. He'd been put on trial. The Sanhedrin essentially, they put him to death. They stoned him in a great response of anger and fury. And so last week we started in Acts chapter 8, and I want to read that verse for you because it sets it up. Stephen, when he fell on his knees, he cried out, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." And when he said this, he fell asleep, and Saul approved of their killing him. And on that day, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. And so as we began there last week, we looked at this response that had taken place against Stephen in the church and looked into all that that meant. I want to remind you of something that Jesus said, and it's then our coffee question. He said to his followers at the very, very beginning, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And so this is our coffee question. What do you think is the blessing Jesus spoke of in this particular verse? You have 6 minutes. Have a coffee. Enjoy it. If you're visiting this morning, we're really glad you're here. What we do is this is our chance just to grab a really good cup of coffee and chat with someone else about this particular question. And hopefully you met somebody that maybe you haven't talked with before, but enjoy this and prime our minds for our study in Acts chapter 8. 6 minutes. So this particular word, blessed, is really, really interesting. It comes from the Greek word makarios. And so it's important that you understand a little bit of the history of this word. There's a book called the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. And in ancient Greek times, the word makarios, blessed, referred to the gods. And so that culture would say the gods were blessed because they lived in a state of happiness and contentment that was beyond all care, labors, and even death. So that was the first way in which the word blessed was used. But then it took on a second meaning, and it referred to the dead, that the dead were blessed because they were now beyond the cares and problems and the worries of earthly life. Finally, there was a third usage that came to this word, makarios, blessed, and it referred to the elite, the wealthy, whose riches and powers put them above the normal cares and problems and the worries of life. Now, the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew, and then it was translated into the Greek language. And so the word blessed, that from the Old Testament, Hebrew, that was translated into Greek was makarios. But the translators used a fourth meaning of this word, meaning the blessings that came to the righteous. So you remember, we're talking about the Old Testament, not the New Testament, but the Old Testament. It was translated from Hebrew into the Greek language. And so this word came to apply to those who lived righteously, who lived rightly. And there were blessings. When you read the Old Testaments, it would talk about earthly and material blessings. Remember Job? It was described, he had lots of possessions. He had good health. His children, he had many children. Those were the blessings that makarios came to refer to because a person lived righteously. Now, when Jesus spoke the Beatitudes, you know, Matthew 5 to 7, that teaching, the Sermon on the Mountain, the Beatitudes, the word he used was makarios. But Jesus turned the meaning of makarios upside down. It didn't refer blessed to the blessing, you know, blessed are the gods, blessed are the dead, blessed are the elite, blessed are those who live rightly. He turned it all upside down in Matthew chapter 5, and you come to discover that he pronounced God's blessing on the lowly, the poor, the hungry, the thirsty, the meek, the mourning, and lastly, for our case today, the persecuted. And what the Beatitudes are they're these prophetic declarations. So you know what I mean by that? He's announcing it ahead of time, saying it's beginning now, but I'm speaking that in the future, with the kingdom of God, these are the realities where blessing will be found. It's an incredible, incredible thing that he did as he taught this way. The Beatitudes almost seem counterintuitive. You go like, blessed are the hungry. I don't know about you, but I ate my hot cross bun at 5:30. I'm already hungry. And I can feel the grumblings. I'm just hoping you won't hear as my stomach growls saying, we need something more. That's why I slurped back my coffee, hoping it would quiet it down. Blessed are the thirsty. Have you ever been thirsty? And you go like, how is that a blessing? And especially when it comes to the last one that we already saw, you know, insults and persecutions and falsely saying things about you. How does he think that there's joy in those kind of things? And of course, what we need to do is read it slowly again. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you. And the key is in that phrase, because of me. See, these things reveal the relationship that one has with Jesus Christ. When they come because of our soul, he's not just saying, blessed are you, you know, general thing when you get insulted, persecuted, falsely say all kinds of evil. That kind of stuff happens regularly. He's talking about when this happens because of him. He says, find joy in that because it indicates you're in relationship with me. Now, the thing that's also puzzling, and I hope you might have got to it, like, what is the reward? Because he says, rejoice and be glad because great is your reward in heaven. And I want you to understand this blessing, this reward that he's speaking of, is an expression of grace. It's unmerited favor. And what he's referring to, in the time of the new heaven and the new earth, there's two things I want to point out to you that will be given to those who follow Jesus. If we endure, we will also reign with him. Now, it's important that you understand this. When God created men, male and female, and he created humankind on the earth, and he gave to them a responsibility, they were to rule over the earth in the sense that they were to steward the creation. And that's why many times you will find people who follow Jesus, they strongly support green policies. Why? Because we understand we're stewards of the earth. We're to care for it, not abuse it or pillage it. And this sense of reigning is when Jesus returns to the earth, the incredible reward that we'll be given is the responsibility that was ours in the beginning will be given to us again. We will rule over with him the earth. We will steward the creation in his on his behalf. And so there will be a purpose, an enduring purpose that will be ours. There's a second thing, and this comes out of Hebrews chapter 10, and he's writing to those believers, and he says, you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. And we all know, like, so all, wherever we live, whether you're renting, whether you're buying, where you live, you regularly have to do stuff to maintain it. If you don't, things start to deteriorate. We also know that there can be tragedies. There were some incredible windstorms this past winter. Some people had trees go down on their houses, and so they have to be repaired. Everything that we live in here will decay. It will wear out. And the promise is given to those who face things in this world because of Jesus, because of their relationship with him. The promise is the reward coming is a better possession and an abiding one. We have a home, a permanent home, that God and Jesus is already preparing for us. And that's why when we talk about when a believer passes away, they're going home. And we all get that. Have you ever been away, especially at Christmas time, ever been away? And I can remember when we were living in Costa Rica and then in Colombia and Venezuela, the time where you got nostalgic for home was Christmas. You wanted to go home. And this is what he's referring to. You know, the stuff we have, we hold loosely, but the promise is there. We have a possession, a better possession, and an abiding one. So those are some of the rewards. Now, in the teaching notes that will be on the website tomorrow, Peter also talks about some other stuff, and I've put in those references there for you. So our passage for today is Acts chapter 8, verse 2 to 8, and this sort of sets it up for us. I want to walk through these verses and then make three quick connections to our lives. So here's a question for you, and then we'll begin to read. Does knowing that God is sovereign and that he rules over heaven and earth, does knowing that everything which touches our lives passes first through his hands, does knowing that persecution and insult are indicators which confirm we are the children of God, does it mean we will never shed tears or grief when difficulties come to our life because of Jesus? And chapter 8, verse 2 gives to us that answer. Godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him. See, as followers of Jesus, there will be times when we grieve for what's taken from us because of our commitment to Jesus. And so when we, it doesn't negate the fact that we trust in the sovereignty of God, that he's in control, but that doesn't mean there are times where we weep. Even Jesus, when he stood outside the tomb of his best friend Lazarus, who had passed away 4 days earlier, and he knew what was going to happen to Lazarus, that he was going to call him out of that tomb and Lazarus would live again, he still did what? He wept at the tomb. And so it's not a contradiction to trust in God's sovereignty and still shed tears. What Paul wrote to the church at Thessalonica, he said to them in verse 13, and he talked about how the two come together. He says, we do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. Now, the best way I can describe this is in my family, my grandpa was the hero. I mean, we dearly loved our grandma, Rowan, but grandpa was the guy from Northern Ireland. He always had a twinkle in his eyes, and, you know, he made everybody love him. And I can remember when my grandpa passed away, and we were all at the funeral home. And, I mean, there's just intense sorrow. And I remember for a time I stood down and I just looked at his body laying there and I said, oh, Grandpa, get up, get up, get out, come back to life. And so we grieved and there were tears that were shed. And then probably a half an hour later, we started telling Grandpa Rowan stories. And we laughed and laughed to the point that tears were coming out of our eyes. And that's the best way I can describe what happens when a person knows Jesus. We do not grieve like the rest of mankind. We grieve who have no hope. We have hope. And we are able to have that mixture of emotions because we knew where Grandpa was. He loved Jesus dearly, and he was in his presence. You see, the believer grieves, but with hope in the sovereign one who promises to walk with us even in the darkest of time. And that's what Psalm 23, verse 4 says. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And the scriptures, as well as church history, confirms God does not carelessly spend or callously waste the lives of his own. Psalm 116, verse 15 says this, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. Now, why is it precious? Because the followers of Jesus are precious to him. Also, our deaths are the moment when we see our Savior for the first time. And that too is a precious moment. Now, there was little time for the church to grieve Stephen's death. Because look at verse 3. But Saul began to destroy the church. Now, Adam Clark's commentary says there's a word, this word destroy is lumeno, and it means to devastate, to ravage. Albert Barnes' note says that lumeno was commonly used in reference to wild beasts, like lions, wolves, bear. You know what they do when they attack. They pounce, they tear, they destroy in order to kill. And this is what Saul was doing when he began to destroy the church. He was acting like a wild animal. That's important for us to understand that. It goes on and it says, Saul began to destroy the church and going from house to house. This tells us that his fury was calculated. He systematically went through Jerusalem, house to house, street by street, searching for what? He was searching for followers of Jesus. And when he found them, the rest of verse 3 tells us what he did. He dragged off both men and women, and he put them in prison. Now, that word dragged off is a word that indicates violence. So he wasn't gentle with people when he grabbed hold of them. He dragged them off. There was force that was used. And the fact, though, that the church was not destroyed as Saul did this is a testimony to the promise that Jesus had given sometime earlier when he still was on the earth, when he said to Peter and to the rest of them, I will build my church. Now, there have been many since Saul who've tried and wanted to do what Saul tried to do, but I want to remind you, nothing can stop Jesus. He will build his church. So this is going on. A great persecution breaks out. Many are scattered. Others are dragged off into prison. And then verse 4 tells us what those who were scattered did. Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. Now, when I read that, I thought, this is not what you expect a person running for their life to do. These believers, when they left Jerusalem, it isn't like they went silent or, you know, the expression, they went dark. You know, they moved in the shadows. You didn't see anything or hear anything from them. What the writer says here, those who've been scattered preached the word. Now, this word preach is really interesting because in our culture, it has come to have a negative connotation. You know what you'll say to a person? Stop preaching at me. Right? When somebody's saying something, have you ever had that? Or you want to mention something about your faith in Jesus, but stop preaching at me. This word originally meant to share good news. And everybody preaches all the time. Let me tell you about my new favorite coffee. Level Ground, Fair Trade, Ethiopia. Do you know that the Ethiopian bean, they've done some of the history, it was one of the first coffee beans. It has a earthy, dark roast. Oh, it's an incredible cup of coffee. I've probably told a number of you about my new favorite coffee. I'm preaching Level Ground coffee when I tell you about that. When the team went to Colombia, we knew that we could go to a medical a travel clinic where you would pay more, but some of us found a pharmacy, and so I will not reveal what that pharmacy is. We'll let all the pharmacies think it's them, but we found a pharmacy where you could get your injections cheaper. Guess what we did? We preached the news to the rest of the team about where you could get cheaper inoculations. I was told by a person who shall not be named of a brand new secret beach that I have not heard about, and I've lived here almost 5 years. Now, if you know what it is, you cannot say what it is unless you've vetted and you're certified that you will also keep this a secret. We love our next-door neighbor, Alberta, but this is just for BC people. And so, but I love this beach. I haven't been there, but I'm going soon, and I am grateful for the person. If you want to know where it is, I can check with them following the service if you can be in the know. See, preaching is not this formal presentation of the gospel as many people think it to be. Those who were scattered, they were not trained preachers. Then what is it? And I want to tell you what it is. Those who were scattered simply gossiped about the one who had risen from the dead, who'd forgiven their sins and given them a new purpose for living. And if someone or something has impacted our lives in a good way, we share that news with other people, just like I've done with you. And by the way, Costco no longer has those 2-pound Ethiopian level ground beans. They sold out of them, so you're going to have to get them in town and pay more. Or watch. They're on the corner right near to the freezer section. See, I just preach some more. Now in verse 5, we go in and it says that Philip went down to a city in Samaria and he proclaimed the gospel, or he proclaimed just where it is. Oh dear, we have a very sad person. He went down to a city in Samaria and he proclaimed the Messiah there. We met Philip back in Acts chapter 6. He was one of the 7 who was chosen by the church to serve as a deacon in the feeding program for widows. Now, it tells us that when Philip left Jerusalem, he was one of those scattered, that he went to this city in Samaria. I can only surmise this was the capital of Samaria. So this was a major city. This is also where the worship of the Samaritans began with the twin calves and all of that there. So this is the city he went to. Now in the next little bit in the description of Philip, 3 different verbs are used, but they're used interchangeably. And again, I want you to understand this: preaching, gossiping, proclaiming, testifying. They all speak to the same action of sharing of good news. But the other thing is that to see what was preached, what was proclaimed, what was testified, what was gossiped about was the word. Of course, that was the word about Jesus, the Messiah. And of course, the Samaritans would have known that word as well. The Messiah was the one who was going to come, the rescuer. The good news of the kingdom of God in the name of Jesus Christ, the word of the Lord, and then they testified about Jesus. And again, the gossip, the preaching, the proclaiming, the testifying was all about the person of Jesus. Now, when Philip did this, verse 6 tells us the reaction. It says that when the crowds heard Philip and saw the signs he performed, they all paid close attention to what he said. And so the 3 things are, is they listened to him, they saw miracles that he was doing, and then they paid even more close attention. So they were intrigued by what he said, but then they saw what he did, and that increased their attention. And it was almost to the sense that word paid close attention is that they held their mind. It was like, you could say they were spellbound. They were fixated on what he had to say to them. Now, the signs that were done by Philip are important for us to note as well. But before I answer that question, there's another one we need to ask. How was Philip able to do the signs that he did? And we find the answer in Jesus, and this is how it always is. But when he began his public ministry, it says that one day as he was teaching, the Pharisees and teachers of the law who'd come from every village of Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem were sitting there present, and the power of the Lord was present for him to heal the sick. And so Jesus performed miracles of healing because the power of the Lord was present in him to do those things. And I'd say to you, that's why Philip was able to do what he did. The power of the Lord was present in him. And the reason the power of the Lord was present in him, because when you go back to Acts 6, he also, one of the qualities that they were looking for in the men who were chosen is that they were full of the Spirit. Philip was full of the Spirit. And so the power of the Lord was available to him. Now, what Philip was able to do through the Spirit is described in verse 7. For with shrieks, impure spirits came out of many, and many who were paralyzed or lame were healed. Now, it was interesting because it was very specifically these 2 kinds of miracles took place. There was people who were freed from possession or oppression of demons, and people who were paralyzed or who were crippled were healed as well. Now, next time, when we press into verse 9 through to 25, it will become clearer to you. But all I want to say today is that we're going to discover that in this city where Philip went, a powerful sorcerer lived. And so it's not a surprise to us that there were many people in that town who were oppressed or possessed by evil spirits. This was a stronghold. The other thing is that this sorcerer did many marvelous things. And the only thing I can think of is he wasn't able to heal crippled or paralyzed people. And so when Philip shows up and begins to share the news of Jesus, what Philip is declaring and what he's announcing through the signs is that Jesus is the greater one. And we're going to find out this Simon described himself as the great one. And there was this contest, as it were, between the person of Jesus and the person of Simon. And so I don't want to jump any further ahead than to tell you, I believe that's why these miracles were taking place. Now, the result was, so there was great joy in that city. And I want to say to you that whenever and wherever the gospel of Jesus is shared and believed, there's great joy. I've never met a person who invited Jesus into their life and then who started crying tears of regret. There's joy. I can remember the night of my commitment to Jesus Christ and the joy I knew in my life that my sins had been forgiven. I had a purpose for living. Many of you could tell the same story. There's joy. And whenever and wherever, as I've said, it's shared, there's this great joy. And it's because of this. The grace of God is shockingly amazing. I tried to find contrasting adjectives that could describe what the grace of God is like. It shocks us in how amazing it is. And the love of God is, it's astonishing in how unexpected it is. We don't expect to be loved like we are when we come to Jesus. And the mercy of God is surprising, but it's incredibly surprising. Because we think, how could he take me? But he did. And that's why there was great joy in this particular city in Samaria. Now, three connections to our lives. From time to time, I've stated it and haven't done it in the last couple months, but I'll say, you know, we've been the church gathered, and we leave to go into a new week as the church scattered. Well, Acts chapter 8 talks about that. The church had gathered in Jerusalem, and now they were scattered out in Judea and Samaria. Both of these actions, gathering and scattering, are important. We gather to build ourselves up in our faith, and then we also gather to spur one another on in our faith, and then we're scattered out into our different neighborhoods, into the different schools of Souk, into different places of purpose, our different places of business. And the reason for it, the purpose that we're scattered, we've already read it in Acts chapter 8, verse 4. To gossip the good news of Jesus. Yes, you're learning and living. Yes, you're teaching. Yes, you're getting an education. Yes, you're, you know, doing stuff around in your yard and you're hanging out with your neighbors. But in all of that, there is this overarching reality that's taking place. We gossip about Jesus. That's one thing that comes out of this passage. And I want to encourage you, you don't need a seminary degree to do that. Second thing is, this question of why could the Spirit give to Philip such incredible power from heaven that he could do the miracles which he did. And I want to tell you is that I believe God trusted Philip. A.W. Tozer, he said this, and ladies, he wrote back in the 60s when this was the standard, he just spoke to the men, I don't know why, but he said, God is looking for men in whose hands his glory is safe. See, God looks for people in whose glory is safe. Simon the sorcerer, we're going to see he boasted he was the great one. Philip's boast was in who? Jesus. And that's why God's glory was safe with him. And it leaves the question to you and I, is the glory of God safe with us? Third thing is this, you and I live in this self-focused culture. It is the norm for people to make everything about life about themselves. But when Jesus reveals himself to a person and they turn their life to him, the orientation of life undergoes this radical transformation and the person becomes God-focused. Now, I can remember one of the sayings when I was a teenager growing up in the early 70s, you know, people would say, I need to find myself. You got to say it like with a real hippie attitude as well, because that goes right, I need to find myself, man. Now, what this passage impresses upon us, the greater need is not to find yourself, but to be found by God. and then set free to live for his glory. And this radical God focus explains the response of the Christians in Jerusalem. They did not leave Jerusalem on the run with this, oh, my world is falling apart, whoa, me, everything's all bad. They left gossiping about Jesus. Why? Because they were focused on the Lord. And it didn't even matter the circumstances. They trusted the sovereign one that he knew. And this explains the stability of their life. Ephesians 4 talks about, he says, people can be tossed back and forth, blown here and there by the cunning and craftiness of those who deceitfully scheme. Have you ever been out in the water? I remember somebody took me fishing and we got caught between the waves like this. Oh my goodness, there's something that happens to our bodies when we are not solid. Everything was out of kilter in my head. That's how some people live. But when there's a God focus, there's a solidness, there's a firmness to our life. We're not easily knocked off balance. We're not frantic or racked with fear. And you see, it's Jesus who makes the difference when he's at the center of our life. So what has the Lord said to you? Invite the team to come back as I just asked these last few questions. But worship team, come on up. What has the Lord said to you through his word? And as you've heard it, how will you respond? There are people who are ready to pray with you and for you. You're welcome to come for prayer as we respond to the Lord with our closing song, or you can come after the service ends as well. But having heard the word, then we're to respond to it. Some of you, you might just draw encouragement that goes, don't stress so much about what you say when you gossip about Jesus. Open your mouth, speak for him. He'll enable you. It might be that other reality that you just can have this confidence that in your God focus, your focus is on the Lord, that he will keep you focused and settled and stable. There may be something else that God's taken out of this passage I never even thought about, but the Spirit has impressed it on your heart as he has. Respond to him, speak to him, commit yourselves to him.